This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and today we have a discussion on solar, on brownfields, and the advantages to cities, and basically what's happening in that area throughout the country. So Artie Arion is going to start us out, followed by Jeff Hinsky, James Orenstein, and a couple others. So go ahead, Artie.
Yes, thanks, Sierra. Yeah, basically, yeah, opportunities for brownfield are a lot. We are talking here directly with EPA and get a great support, get a, everything that we were so far asking for. But we also see lots of challenges because there is some pre-assessment done. They know a little bit about what kind of solar capacity might be installed on each of these brownfield sites. But what they are not very sure about is the cleanup cost and all kind of other challenges that we're going to deal with if we need to do the installation. So there is much more details necessary. And so we have to decide which of the sites makes most sense and where are the stakeholders more pro and more interested in continuing working with us on that project. But it's a lot of work and efforts that you need to put in advance. And but as long as that everybody is pretty supportive, that would be a big advantage for us.
Okay.
And Sierra, this is Charlie. I don't know if that was you calling me, but I am now, in fact, on.
Yes, actually, it was me. So thank you. I saw that.
Well, were you getting nervous?
Well, yeah. Yeah, I have to round up speakers sometimes. They get busy or they forget. It happens.
Yeah.
You all know as of last phone call. So.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to go with Jeff Hinsky. Do you want to go ahead with Jeff? And then, Charlie, you can follow James Orenstein.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. Morning or afternoon, everyone. This is Jeff Hinsky from Clean Focus and Green Skies. Just a little bit of background. Green Skies and Clean Focus is really the same company, or it's two separate companies under operating under the same umbrella. Green Skies is kind of the development slash construction side of it, and Clean Focus is the long-term asset owner operator. And so generally we build projects for our own portfolio and, you know, take long-term ownership and operation responsibilities under PPAs typically. We are one of the largest C&I developers in the country, with over 250 megawatts of operating projects since our founding a little less than 10 years ago. So kind of Green Skies is headquartered in Connecticut, North Haven, Connecticut. And so we have a pretty strong base in the Northeast. A good portion of our activities are in the Northeast. On the other hand, we have, you know, some capacity or systems running in 27 different states. You know, primarily California and the Southeast is where the other chunk is, and, you know, a few megawatts here and there in some other states. That being said, specifically brownfields, and we like brownfields. We like particularly in the Northeast. To date, right now, I just looking this morning, you know, preparation, we've got over 23 megawatts operating on landfills. Actual operating systems under PPAs to the local municipality, or in some cases the co-ops that the municipalities are involved in. We've got about 6 megawatts currently in the development and construction phase, and we got about another 13 megawatts that we are what we'd call our pipeline that aren't necessarily contracted, but we're, you know, actively pursuing. So. You know, in terms of overall activities, it's a big chunk of our business, or you know, a reasonable chunk, certainly of 10% or so. And one of the reasons we like it, and you know, Ari mentioned there are development difficulties or complications, which I'll get into in a bit, but particularly in the Northeast, the landfills are particularly the community-owned ones or the ones that are near the municipalities, are generally full and capped and haven't been active in a long time. And obviously that's one of the requirements to even consider development on it. And so these municipalities have, you know, tens of acres and sometimes even more of land that more or less they can't do anything with. And it's, you know, can't be developed for any kind of housing or commercial development. They can't put, you know, you put a park on it per se, but it can't be actively used as a park in the sense that you can't have, you know, picnics and things there or whatever. So it's a big open field with little value at this point other than, you know, allowing the fill over the course of decades to, you know, eventually, hopefully, decompose. And so this really provides them an opportunity to utilize that land. Typically how we structure, there's two different ways we structure these. In either way, it's, you know, it's a financial benefit to the municipality. One is we will lease the land and, you know, pay, make a direct monthly or quarterly payment to the municipality for the use of the land. And yeah, we sell the power to, in that case, typically is because we're selling power to a collection of municipalities around the area or maybe some of the co-ops, as I mentioned before. And so there's not a direct one-on-one relationship to any municipality. And then in other cases where there is, we sign a PPA with the municipality to take all of the power, and, you know, with a $0 or, you know, nominal lease. But with that, we can actually get a very low cost of power to them. So, you know, either way, the municipality that owns this is a real winner here. That being said, as already mentioned, there are development complications. You know, obviously the challenges in being able to abide by EPA rules as well as local or state rules that around disturbing. You know, generally you can't penetrate the cap, so instead of using piles or other kind of anchoring systems, you've got to use ballasted systems. You know, big tubs of concrete fundamentally. And you need to be very careful. Obviously, you can't do any trenching to run your conduits underground. You can't do often you can't use a lot of heavy equipment when you're trying to do the, you know, the actual construction activity themselves. So there's a lot of considerations that need to be taken. But, you know, obviously we've got the experience and we've done enough of them that we kind of know what it is going in. These complications do add some costs. You know, kind of a rough estimate. You know, it'll cost maybe 10%, 15% more than if you had just like a clean, you know, open land that you're building on. But you know, that's usually more than made up with because again, the land is relatively cheap in terms of what you're going to have to pay in terms of rent. So it pays off. And then the other last comment I wanted to make is, you know, one of the areas that is emerging right now that's actually pretty interesting and we're looking pretty aggressively at in especially New Jersey, but not just New Jersey, is siting community solar projects on landfills. And one of the reasons why New Jersey is particularly interesting is during their current program, which is officially a pilot program, there is limited capacity, and so they score the projects that get submitted, and brownfield-sited systems get extra points, if you will. And last year's round of solicitation, pretty near three-quarters of the awarded projects were on brownfields. And so, you know, it's a real interesting space. There's some activities going on in Massachusetts as well. And again, you know, the brownfields broadly and landfills in particular are an interesting opportunity as we see it.
Okay. We have some background noise. So somebody needs to mute their phone. Otherwise, I'll mute the entire group and unmute the speakers. fun. This is good. All right. So, James Ornstein, do you want to go ahead and talk a little bit here? I didn't mute you, so you should be okay. Are you there, James?
Try again. Hello?
There we go. Oh, yeah, we got you.
Okay. My name is James Ornstein. I actually do mostly volunteer work here in Texas in the what we call North Central Texas or Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I volunteered just to say a brief few words about some things that are going on that I'm not actually involved in, but I've been trying to make contact with and find out as much as I can about. So one of the issues with the, I would say, brownfield solar in Texas is, of course, you're competing with a very low cost of energy here, so it kind of adds the financial pressures on it. But my take on it is that there's a growing interest in municipalities in developing climate action plans, and so because of that, there's some added incentives for the cities to subsidize things, and I think that's kind of kicked off some activities. So personally, I'm most interested in the city of Dallas because that's the area where I live, and they just recently passed a comprehensive environmental and climate action plan. So it kind of covers both bases there. And they're definitely interested. They don't have any money right now, partly because of the city budget in general and partly because of the extra hit from the COVID crisis. But they did provide me with a statement. So the update on the city of Dallas is that they've received a technical assistance grant from the DOE National Community Solar Partnership Program to explore the feasibility of solar infrastructure on the closed Deepwood landfill, which is in a part of town that's kind of in an underserved community. It's right near the part of the Trinity River and some forest areas, and there's actually an Audubon Nature Center near the property, so it's kind of out in the boonies a little bit. But so in any case, to continue, the long-term objective of the project would be to provide reliable, affordable energy to help reduce the energy burden on neighboring communities. Project is still in the very early exploratory stages. The other experience that Dallas has is this is a closed landfill that's been out of business for a long time, which fits in with other people have said that that's the way to go. I believe it's public knowledge that they had explored putting something on an operating landfill and kind of decided not to. Even though there was a closed section of the operating landfill, they decided that it was probably too much liability involved and even being anywhere near it. So I don't know if that's a common problem or not. Then the other thing that's going on is in the Houston area. And the other thing to say about Dallas is they're in a deregulated electric market part of Texas. So we've got a mix of municipal utilities and co-ops and deregulated areas. So that complicates things when you're working in a deregulated area. But in any case, in Houston, there's also another deregulated area. And also, I believe it was part of their climate action initiatives. But they applied for a grant through, I think it was called the C40 Cities Initiative or something. And so they've got a project that's called Sunnyside Energy that's actually pretty far along. And the previous speaker mentioned community solar projects, and this is another case where the majority, I think 95% of it is a commercial development, and 5% of it is being developed as a community solar project. So that's partly why the city is interested, again, because of the underserved communities aspect. So the statement that I got from one of the developers was they are currently working with the city to get the lease signed. Simultaneously, they've submitted to ERCOT, which is the grid operator here, for interconnection and are preparing submission to TCEQ, which is the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, for the restoration permit. and they're in a they divide the competitive areas into transmission distribution utility zones. So folks living in the center point territory that wanted to explore being a subscriber in the community, they've enlisted a group which people are probably familiar with called Solar United Neighbors. And so they're kind of organizing the customer acquisition part of the project. And they have an FAQ that they put on the Solar United Neighbors site that has a lot more details. And that's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much. I'm going to save you for last, Charlie. And we have Norman Lukefeather here. I'm sorry, Lukefeather. Do you want to talk a little bit, Norm?
Yeah, that'd be fine. My name is Norman Lukefeather. I live in Annapolis, Maryland. I've been doing solar since 1974 when I started the federal government solar energy program at the Federal Energy Administration. And in 78, after we got $200 million for solar in 1977 for DOD facilities, I started the International Solar Program, and I've been doing solar overseas ever since, and here too. We've been working on a solar park, or what they call Annapolis Renewable Energy Park, for some time. We started in 2008, but then the mayor was going to be out of office in a matter of months. So it turned out that it became a political football for several years. But we finally got it done in 2018, and it's been operating. It's about 18 megawatts, and it's a very successful operation. Obviously, it has to be close to the users, and we have shopping centers, malls, and things in close proximity, so there's takeoff. And that was, of course, always a major issue. Where are you going to take the power? There are other landfills in our county, Anne Arundel County. They've been considering putting solar on the other landfills as well. The one we did was, I was not involved in the contractor aspects of it, but I was involved in it from a planning standpoint from the very beginning. There are other landfills that we're looking to do over a period of time, and each one has a takeoff point in close proximity. There's also a large dairy farm that they're thinking about, which is close to a large set of shopping centers. I've been talking to the Maryland Environment head of Solid Waste Division, and he and I are going to be meeting next week again. And my feeling is there are just a lot of landfills in the state of Maryland that are ready to be permitted for a landfill with solar on top. Obviously, you have to go through the permitting process with EPA, et cetera. But they're looking forward here in Maryland to doing other landfills because we have a bunch that are either closed or sufficiently inactive so that we can put solar on them. So I look at Maryland and other places in the East Coast for solar on landfill as being a very promising area. Obviously, you can't do much more with a landfill. As was mentioned, you can make a park on it, and we have a couple that have been approved for parks here in Maryland. You can do ball fields and all, but there are a couple that are currently in process of being approved for solar. So I think we have a real thriving potential here in Maryland, and I think Maryland would just be one of many states. If you can do it in one place, you can do it in another. I happen to be involved in the real estate business as well. And I was on the, as a matter of fact, I headed up back in 1995-96, headed up the Maryland Industrial and Commercial Task Force for the Maryland Association of Realtors when we lobbied for 2 years to get the Brownfields legislation through. And in fact, we did, after 2 years of lobbying, we got it through. And it's been a real boon. Obviously, solar on landfills and other brownfield sites makes a lot of sense. And that's really all I have to say. I can ramble on more, but my feeling is it's really, in my view, solar on landfills, to me, is the most promising, most useful use of solar energy, other than if you design new housing communities, put them on all the roofs of the community, and maybe you have communities with east-west streets and north-south streets, so that you can have properly facing roofs, and you can build a community that makes sense. And there are several, obviously, here that are moving ahead. California's ahead of us, I'm sure. But solar on landfills is a real promising area for us here in Maryland and elsewhere in the East.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Charlie, you're up. He's going to talk a little bit about the legal aspects of solar on landfill.
Yep. And let me first just check in. When do you want me to stop talking?
Sorry.
Anyone who works with me knows this is the most important issue to negotiate ahead of time.
Well, go ahead for a few minutes here, and then we'll open it up, maybe 5-10 minutes at most, and then we can open it up to Q&A.
Oh, my God. I've never talked this before. Okay, first, real quick about me. First, it's really great to be on this group. Baird turned me on to this group, or turned me on to Sierra. The collective wisdom on this call, on the website, on the group of experts, is just really remarkable and cool. I am an environmental lawyer and energy lawyer. 28 years at EPA, where my focus was on the focus was on what EPA did, which is going to be one of my points. So EPA deals with the really bad sites, right? Superfund sites, they call it RIC or corrective action. But I also did a lot of work coordinating with state programs, which typically handle less contaminated sites. And often state programs have two different tracks. The least intrusive for the least scary sites are called voluntary cleanup programs. I actually left for a year in 2008 to be general counsel for a renewable energy development company working on wind and solar. I will close with the war story that I know Sierra's already heard, but I will say that for the end of my 5 minutes from that time. Went back to EPA. Whoever the colleague is from Maryland, probably familiar with the Sparrows Point site in Baltimore Harbor. I worked on that as sort of an EPA negotiator, trying to come up with agreements that would make the state and EPA and the new purchaser happy and sort of settle their resolve or add certainty to their liability. That's what I do mostly. That's what I'm going to be talking about a little bit here. How do you deal with uncertainty in these projects? That's sort of what I do. Left EPA in 2018, went into private practice, joined a firm in New York City that found me, the head of their environmental group. In that context, I got sort of, in addition to taking care of whatever other people want you to do, I'm the general counsel outside for a company which some of you may be familiar with, Customized Energy Solutions, based in Philadelphia, but works in retail and wholesale markets around the country and in other countries, basically helping to manage, from an economic and operational point of view, other folks' projects. We handle all of Google's projects, managing for them. So I sort of keep my hand in energy stuff. That's enough about me. The last thing I should mention is when I came back to EPA in 2010, I joined as a side gig the national effort that EPA has called Repowering America. So it's a website, has a lot of resources. I was sort of the legal guy on it. For those of you who are new to this, a great source of information. Okay, so a couple of discrete points. I think it's important to realize, first of all, what we're talking about when we're talking about contaminated lands. So even on this call, I hear people thinking that the only, and I've heard it said before, and maybe debate if it's true or not, you know, the sweet spot is on that capped, closed landfill, that municipal landfill that's been closed long enough so that settling has happened, the methane is largely gone. You don't have to put a system on that has to be tweaked too much as settling happens over time. Little liability was on the Superfund. And certainly those are, in some ways, the easiest to do. And there's much less uncertainty in the market about the legal risks associated with them. But, you know, I'm really here to tell you that that's not the only place these could go to go on. And if you have any old industrial facility, even if it's still owned by someone, and they've got 40 back acres that used to be a methyl ethyl death pit, they might well be willing to lease to you, holding on to all liability because they already have it. So you just have to sort of promise not to muck things up, and that's an issue. But there are opportunities out there beyond that closed landfill, is point one. Point two about these sites. We want to emphasize this. There is a range of these sites that all merit sort of being looked at. And while the easier ones are the ones that are sort of least interest to the government, so let's say that's that closed landfill that isn't on the EPA Superfund list, wasn't corrective action, in some ways that's the easiest to do. But again, that's not the only one to do. Third point, why are these things worth looking at? You know, why is this worthy of interest? A couple things people have talked about, but I want to just sort of emphasize a few more that sometimes get forgotten. Often closer to load than that farm field out in the middle of nowhere. So if you can find a site that, you know, is the former GM plant, is the former whatever, closer to load. Much less likelihood of a NIMBY issue. People don't want to see Farmer Brown's farm turn neighbors, and sometimes the taxing authorities don't want to see Farmer Brown's farm turn into a solar farm when they would be fine with it turning into Walmart. But, you know, turn that old landfill into a solar farm, fantastic. Infrastructure often already in place. If that was an old industrial facility or even a landfill, it probably was, you know, serviced for electricity of some sort. So you've got a way to get the power out, both technically, although it may need to be rewired, as well as legal. My experience has been that often that legal piece is difficult. Anything else on this? It's protecting open space. And finally, some policy drivers. I heard it mentioned on this call. A number of states give extra juice to a renewable energy project that is on a environmentally impaired land. So Massachusetts, this may be a program that's now all filled up and they're coming up with something new, but at least at one point, Massachusetts, I think, gave 3 RECs for every megawatt hour of power. Delaware has policies in place to sort of encourage putting these on brownfields. So it's often, as someone has mentioned on this call, it's often easier to get a project on one of these than on that farm field. Okay, so those are sort of some of the pros, right? But what are the cons? And my experience is that when I'm talking to folks about this or there's sort of new clients coming in the door, they typically fall into one or the other of the following two categories. People who are experienced renewable energy developers who are just as scared of that possibility of liability. So they don't know about that soil liability, scary stuff. Or brownfield redevelopers are people who are comfortable with developing contaminated land, but don't know anything about this hard-to-understand energy market and sort of distributed generation projects. And what I try to do is to sort of bring those two groups together. Okay, I've just got two more things I want to mention, and then I'll be done. So on the liability side, basically, you know, what you're talking about with one of these projects is how do I at least quantify and ideally limit any liability? and to do so with respect to federal government, state government, and some third party. So that's what you're thinking about, right? And so you ideally want to come up with a plan, and this is something that, you know, your lenders will want to know. So some lenders are much more comfortable than others. Some financing partners are much more comfortable than others with financing on anything related to environmentally impaired property. Generally, both the feds and states have, to varying degrees, statutory safe harbors that if you stay within, you'll be able to avoid liability. A fairly big one at the federal level just got passed as part of the 2018 Build Act. Under Superfund before this act, there was a very clear-cut statutory safe harbor for someone who purchased it, bought it in fee simple, did all appropriate inquiry, you know, went looking for stuff, looking for bad stuff, contamination. Totally fine if they found it. They found methyl ethyl death. They will still not be liable so long as they don't make it worse and they cooperate with the government. Prior to 3 years ago, that only applied to owners, not to lessees. And so since, you know, most of the of renewable energy developers prefer to lease and not buy the land, that was an issue. One of the things I did at EPA was to work on guidance that basically, as a matter of enforcement discretion, extended the same safe harbor to lessees that buyers had. Well, that guidance became moot 3 years ago because Congress statutorily added the exception to add in for tenants. So final sort of big points are, understand that there are various statutory safe harbors or enforcement guidance that's sort of written out generally. And finally, at both the federal and state level, especially given the premium, the incentive, the goal, the policy goals that many states at least, and maybe at some future day, the federal government again, given the excitement and that they have for renewable energy projects, you can typically find within the federal, or certainly within the state, even within the federal folks, someone who will write a letter, they're called comfort letters, that say, here is what we understand about this site, we state agency, we federal agency, and we understand you're planning to follow this plan that your EPC contractor is prepared, or whoever's prepared as to how you're going to build this thing. You're going to use ballasted facilities on top of the landfill. You're only going to puncture at these sort of particular areas. Could be at worst. I mean, again, a lot of people say, oh, anything that's an active landfill or even our landfill that's recently closed, stay away from it. There are folks out there who are developing on partially closed landfills, planning to then put solar, you know, expand the solar as it gets closed, and people are building on recently closed landfills and other sites, but they're designed so that you can readjust the angle, the tilt, as settling happens. I think I'll stop there. And sort of with these closing thoughts, it's all about allocation of risk, which is, you know, what any business deal is. I'll close with my little war story. It was 2008. I was outside of EPA. I was working for the renewable energy developer. They'd acquired an option for 80 acres of land in New Jersey at a time when SREC values there were very, very high. It looked like it was going to be a great project. Farmer Brown was selling his land. Unfortunately, our development team had not been there. Who knows? Thank God I wasn't there, so there was no question I hadn't screwed up. But someone screwed up, and 6 months prior to when we signed the option, the town had passed a law restricting all solar development to areas that were zoned industrial. Why? In New Jersey, solar equipment is not taxed. So if you're a town father or mother and looking to see Farmer Brown sell, you're sad to lose Farmer Brown. But as between the solar developer that's not going to give off any tax revenue, and Walmart or the mixed-use development that's going to throw off, you know, real jobs over a long period of time plus taxes, you know, solar ain't so sweet. So my job is to go out there and convince the town mothers and fathers at a town council meeting to change the zoning back. I went out there, I made my pitch, I talked about a pilot agreement, you know, some way to sort of sweeten the pot. Totally went down in flames. They weren't buying it. Afterwards, the mayor came up to me and said, boy, I wish you had come and talked to me. I wish you guys would come and talk to us earlier. We own an old municipal landfill. You know, we don't think there's anything bad in it, but we will hold on to all liability. We would totally indemnify you. We would lease it to you for not a lot. Why don't you talk to us about that site? And that's what all of us on this phone are doing who are working on these sites. We're trying to get people over that hump of uncertainty with respect to, oh, scary liability, to see these things as sort of the really valuable, locations of the art. I forget who my colleague was a few minutes ago who said that they're so excited about this. I totally share that enthusiasm. One of my clients is an entity that just bought the South Philadelphia refinery, and they're going to be taking it down and building, at least building some warehouses, hopefully some other stuff. But one of the things that I'm hoping they will recognize the value of is that those areas of that property you can't build on because of environmental contamination, ongoing pump and treat, that would be a perfect place for solar, right next to a high voltage distribution line, right next to load in Philadelphia. Anyway, I'll stop there.
Okay, we're going to open this up to open conversation here. So if anybody has any comments or questions, just dive in, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, this is Rick Reeves-Hain from Boston University, and I'm curious about the role that environmental insurance could play in addressing that uncertainty when dealing with a site which might have some contamination. And I'm wondering if maybe we should be looking at legislation for states to provide subsidies for environmental insurance, to encourage the insurance companies to offer environmental insurance for this purpose, to attract people to the more problematic sites.
That's interesting. This is Charlie. My first reaction is those insurance firms and brokers who are already making money off this, they won't like that. But anyway, this is my perspective. Whatever it takes to help with this hump, with this uncertainty, would make a difference. I don't know what kind of appetite legislatures would have for that use of tax dollars. I'm saying that neutrally, not as a that I think it wouldn't be the case. Anyway, those are my thoughts.
Well, I just want to say part of the climate action plan for the state. It might be appetizing because there's a lot of potential at hazardous waste sites.
Yep. Yep.
Any other comments on that? Dive in.
Does anyone have any horror stories?
Yeah. I have a question.
Yeah, go ahead and introduce yourself, please.
Lynn Arthur from Southampton. Curious to know if anyone has done a CDG project, like a community solar, with a CCA, a community choice aggregation program, you know, anywhere in the country. Obviously, there's only, I think, 7 states where community choice aggregation is active. But if any of the speakers could comment, that would be of value.
This is Jeff from Green Skies. Yeah, we actually have a system with the city of Roseville, California. Actually, just went live about a year ago now. That is not truly a CCA, but they have a municipal utility. And so it's a utility-run community solar, but it's treated from the off-taker's point of view, it actually looks more like a CCA. We are actively working on some systems for CCAs in California, but none are if you will, under construction. But none of them are brownfield either. So you know, I think the combination of the two, you know, just because of the attractiveness of brownfield sites, would be something we'd be very interested in. But you know, the CCA model is just kind of getting off the ground in a number of the states in the Northeast, and so you know, it's not a ton of activities of them actually sourcing power themselves yet.
If I could just comment further, we're in the process of trying to get a CCA on Long Island for the first time. The notion of a municipality having, you know, they own the landfills, like someone said earlier, they are, I mean, where I am at least, they are all capped for many, many years. The cost of land here is prohibitive. Big solar arrays are just not popular because the land value is just tremendous. But having, a CDG project or a community solar project, and doing that with CCA in an opt-in, you know, it's just such a home run. But what we need is developers who, you know, can put that together, and start working with the municipality, I guess. But I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Charlie. Someone else should go.
Go ahead. Who else?
Sorry. Go ahead,
Charlie.
Just two thoughts. One, two data points. One is in Minnesota. My very first client private practice for all of $1,000 was a Council on Development Finance Agencies. I commend that group to you in general for some sort of brownfield issues. But anyway, they had me go out to Minnesota, which has a Brightfields initiative aimed specifically at the fact that in Minnesota, somewhat uniquely, there are, I think, 20 or 30 former municipal landfills which have been taken over and are owned by the state. So the state was had basically provided for their capping, had paid for it with general obligation bonds, and the goal or the question was how could they be made into brightfields. And while Minnesota doesn't have community solar, some of the individual utilities, I'm thinking of two of the, I think they're munis, functionally created community solar on brownfields. And I'm just blanking on the name of the one who I actually got to tour, but it was a brownfield site. And, you know, part of the marketing, as I recall, was you're getting this off of not Farmer Brown's land, but of a brownfield. And the second data point is what New Jersey has done, and I'm thinking it's PSE&G as part of how they met their original obligations under their renewable portfolio standard. It wasn't community solar per se. So even as I say, this may not be relevant. But I seem to recall a conversation with someone whereby they were at least looking at what functionally would have been community solar. I do know that they built maybe four or five of them on landfills. So I guess the data point would be to look up PSE&G and see if my memory trace it, is it all right. So that's what I got.
Okay, we had one other person who was trying to speak. Go ahead.
Yes, Artie Arian. We're having about 20 megawatt under development with different CCAs here in California. So Marine Clean Energy is one of them, Monterey Bay Community, Valley Clean Energy, a couple more. None of them is brownfield so far. We are looking at a huge list of different opportunities of brownfield sites, but as I said in the beginning, there are different challenges when you want to get in touch with the landowner, make him interested in that. It's always not a site that is under control of the any kind of city or government authority. Maybe owned by a third party most of the time. So the question is how we can find the lease agreement. Jeff mentioned it already, how we usually discuss long-term lease and then also selling the electricity. But we very much enjoy working with CCAs since they have the right targets and also the way of how they set up the program with automatically opting in their subscribers. That's a great advantage. One of the disadvantages that we keep seeing with CCAs is they're very much concerned on being competitive in terms of the pricing, so they feel a lot of pressure in case if they have to drive up their prices to their subscribers, that a lot of them might opt out. It never happens, but they don't. This is kind of their nightmare. And wherefore, these kind of brownfields, when you have to charge more for the investment to make it happen, that is a little bit challenging for them to negotiate this. So, as I said, there are lots of opportunities and great things to do, but we have to be just very cautious in terms of costs and how to make the investment feasible.
Okay. Anybody who has not yet had a chance to speak would like to say something? Nope. Okay.
Hi, Chris.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, Chris, go ahead.
Hi, folks. Chris Carrick from Central New York Regional Planning Board in Syracuse. I'm wondering if anyone knows or has any experience with using a solar PV at a landfill to functionally serve as a landfill cap for landfills. They don't yet have a cap. But there was a project in Germany in 2017 that won an award for doing so. They used Canadian solar modules, and the installation approach was to fit them very tightly together and on drip edges to use a gutter system effectively to transmit water off the landfill and prevent leaks. Does anyone know of any projects like that in the United States or have any experience with that?
Anybody,
yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll take a shot at this. So first, there's a, I know I've seen, and you know, was it CGI or was it a real one? But I've seen certainly pictures of what seemed to be a geotextile cap going on to a landfill, followed by sort of flexible thin film, solar. I'm actually conservative on that. I would, the out, my, unless the technology is, or the outputs have really changed, you know, this sort of classic, you know, crystalline PV, has, you know, I still think fairly higher, output efficiency. And my thought would be that the trouble with this systems that where it's all sort of integrated into one thing is that if there's ever a problem, either with, you know, particular modules or heaven forbid, something happening with the cap that is bad enough that someone says you got to fix it. When you've got the solar generation component so tightly interconnected with the capping piece, that could be challenging. So I think that's one thing where I think my gut sense is to be pessimistic and to say that it's better to have. And by the way, we talk about a cap. you need a cap typically that's, some sort of, synthetic artificial thing on that methyl ethyl death site. There's plenty of caps that are just compacted clay and sod and grass, that are sort of on the lower end of the scale of dangerousness. So just want to be sure that people realize that. But, yeah, I think, and maybe I'm wrong in this, but I would be, as counsel for a developer or even for the city or anyone who's either the person who's holding on to liability or the person who's trying to limit liability, the developer, I would be nervous about technology where, it's all sort of intertwined. But I'd love to hear if anyone else has any contrary thoughts or experiences.
Any of your developers out there have any comments on that? Jeff, Artie?
This is Jeff. We I think would shy away from something like that at this point. Everything we've done to date has been something that's been capped and has some time to, like you said, settle. It's a lot safer, and again, I think there's so many at this point that maybe there's too many unknowns to say, how do you incorporate the capping and the solar as one kind of integrated thing?
Let me shill for that EPA Repowering America site again. One of the last things we put out, at least while I was still there, and I know it's still up on the website, is some really, I think, useful tactical documents, not legal, tactical, on how to both incorporate solar PV onto an existing landfill cap and how to do it as part of building a cap. So I stick with the notion that the whole thing being all one sort of cap doesn't make sense, but there's a lot of ways out there to sort of efficiently put down the cap and the separate solar panels at the same time. So I really do commend that site to folks.
All right. Before we go any further, I have some questions. I have sent out a schedule yesterday, calendar schedule. I'm not sure if everybody got it. I don't think they did. I sent another one out today, and I've been having some technology issues related to emails and calendars. So did anybody get that, or did you not get that calendar invitation for two different events in September?
I think Charlie got at least one, is my recollection.
Yeah, okay. I think I got them both, I believe.
Did you? Okay, so one would be September 2nd. It's talking about renewable energy and agricultural land, and the other one is going to be Larissa talking about Peter Fox Tanner's book, Power After Carbon, on September 3rd. Did you get both of those, everybody?
I did. Norman did. September 2nd one, but not anything for September 3rd.
Yeah, September 3rd would be the one with Larissa. Anybody get that one?
I got it, Norman.
Okay. It has been really frustrating for me because I never know if it's going to work. And I actually got them in my own box yesterday when I sent them out, so I thought they went out successfully.
I've got the September 3rd one as well. It was looking in the calendar. So, I got them both.
Yeah, I sent them again today, a second time, just to make sure. That's good news.
Question, did you send something out for September the 1st as well?
Yeah, we have a webinar. It's going to be pretty interesting. Clean and Rob is going to be talking about, analysis of renewable energy and procurement options for municipalities, and quite in depth. A lot of you attorneys might want to see if you can make it to that one. It's going to be a good webinar.
I got that one off.
What's the date of that,
okay.
Sarah?
That one's on September 1st. It's early in next week, actually. It was three things next week.
Okay, I didn't get that. I'll have to look.
Yeah, I have to reword the title of that. I'm not getting a lot of response, and somehow the content is very strong. So I'm thinking about how to word it so that people understand what she's trying to do, because she has a very good presentation. So
let me this just I don't know what the most efficient way is to get this out, but are folks aware of the legal pathways to deep decarbonization project that is an outgrowth of Mike Gerard's and John Dernbach's legal pathways to deep decarbonization book?
Let's not go that way right now.
Okay.
Let's kind of stay with this. Send me an email, Charlie, and I'd be happy to put that into a conference call because it sounds like a longer conversation than the couple minutes we have left.
Yep.
Yeah. So anybody, any other comments or whatever on this topic? We'll deal with some of these other topics in longer conversations.
Yeah, this is Rick Reepstein again at Boston University. I'm just curious if people think there's an opportunity
to benefit environmental justice communities. Some of these blighted areas, and you may have low-income people nearby. And is there a way that a deal can be structured to provide access to community solar for those populations?
Mm. That's exactly what we're trying to maybe make happen in South Philadelphia.
Are you getting any help for the city?
I would comment as well that it seems, or there certainly is a trend, that more and more of the community solar programs being rolled out by states have significant incentives and or requirements for low-income subscribers. And so I think part of it is around program design, and it's going to happen more and more. Now, it has less to do with, the siting, although, again, brownfields would be good places to site these projects as well.
So New York State is making this a priority, and I would recommend, if folks are interested in this, going to the New York State Climate Action Council website and drilling down to the Climate Justice Committee work of the council, because the committee had this exact conversation in their last meeting.
Who was that just spoke?
Chris Carrick.
This is Chris Carrick.
Hi, Serta. Okay, we have a couple of minutes left. One more comment. Okay, tomorrow we have a webinar, and it should be a fairly interesting one. Hopefully you can all make it. It is talking about advanced energy communities, basically creating a plan for resilience in communities. And we have Kurt Johnson and Lorenzo Christoph, two presenters tomorrow at noon Eastern time. And then on Thursday, on the 27th, we have another Community Choice Energy update in the different states. Now, Lynn, I assume you're still going to be on that, right? Are you here, Lynn?
Yes. My phone was muted. Yes, I am.
I understand that's a problem. Samuel Golnick should be on it. I'll have to remind him, but he was planning on it. Peter Millman from Connecticut, they're working on a CCA over there. Bob Elliott's a part of the group, but I've never had him come to a meeting yet. And Dave Dupereau, you still planning on being here, Dave, tomorrow, or Thursday?
I think I can, yes.
Okay, super. So we have a panel. It should be a really interesting conversation, and it is time. So any other quick comments here? I think we're all in pretty good shape.
This is great stuff, Sarah. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for the panelists. Good conversation again. And, hope to see you all next couple of days and next week. So always looking for ideas for panels, so shoot me an email if you have some ideas at sierra@msceforum.com. And one other thing, too, all of you are on the contact information is on the website under Connect on the left-hand side of msceforum.com. Meet the experts, and all your names and contact information is there, as well as in the emails that I send out. So if you have any reason to connect to somebody in the group, there you go. You've got all the information that you need to do that. All right. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for coming, and talk to you soon.
Good.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.